It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. While the movie The Martian occupies the top spot at the box office, the recent discovery of water on Mars is keeping the red planet in the news. However, the current Mars mania is nothing new. Pop culture contributor Joe Woese joins us for a look at a Pittsburgh inventor who came up with a plan for contacting Mars in the early 20th century. Joe Woese, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh.
Always great to be here.
People are fascinated by the possibility of life on Mars to this day, but the public's excitement began much earlier because of a mistranslation. Explain this.
Yes. So in 1877, there's an astronomer by the name of Giovanni Schiaparelli, and he discovers what he calls canali on Mars. It's the Italian word for marks or grooves or channels. This gets translated to canals. Canals, of course, would have been man-made objects to transport water.
Or so kind of being.
Yes, or Martians for that matter. So this then sort of, you know, spreads across the world that they've discovered canals on Mars. And, you know, this gets further pushed. In 1895, an American astronomer named Percival Lowell publishes a book on Mars, and he begins to speculate that, you know, the changes in the colors and gradations are based on the crops for that time of year. He just continues to build onto this story.
And somebody builds a powerful telescope, and they imagine seeing gondolas floating in those.
You know, what's funny is that Percival does imagine that some of these, you know, canals are built around cities that claims to have seen.
Wow. So,
you know, not everyone had a telescope to verify it. So the people start buying into these ideas.
Well, I suppose back then, a lot of this was unverifiable. And if you thought someone was telling you something who claiming to be having a scientific background, you were likely to believe them. Case in point, the whole War of the Worlds broadcast. And, you know, there's that whole part where the professor is saying, you know, well, I can assure you there are no canals despite the popular conjecture of the day, which was, as you're saying, quite popular.
Yes, absolutely.
So Tesla was at first ignored, but Marconi was taken much more seriously. So who were his supporters and did he have skeptics?
So Tesla announces in 1899 that he had received some mysterious message from outer space. And it's sort of dismissed because Tesla is sort of regarded as, you know, his science is regarded as sort of parlor magic, you know, these tricks with electricity he's doing, but doesn't have the same practical application as Marconi. Marconi, you know, he's found ways to communicate with the entire world. So Thomas Edison gets right behind him and says, yes, this is very plausible. This is actually very likely. But he did have detractors, too. Dr. Charles Abbott, who was the director of Astrophysical Observatory at the Smithsonian, said this is ridiculous, this is ludicrous, this message obviously did not come from Mars, it must have come from Venus. So there's, you know, even those who are his loudest detractors still say, yeah, this is a message from outer space.
And you know, there's also fueling a lot of this is the original novel War of the Worlds, written by H.G. Wells, no relation to Orson Welles, who did the radio show. And it, of course, remains a seminal work of science fiction. But did this have an impact on the conversation, on the discussion among the scientists?
It certainly did, because it was raising new questions. You know, this is a time at which we're starting to say, well, you know, maybe we're not alone. But how should we prepare for this? How do we respond? Well, you know, what is alien life going to look like, be like? Should we be defending ourselves against it? And so scientists start to really take this seriously and sort of develop plans for how to communicate and how are we going to respond in case there's an attack. So it really becomes something tangible to people.
And there was the story that Earth had received an alleged message from Mars.
Yeah, so Marconi announces what he received as a three-dot signal. And he translates this, he believes it's the Morse code letter S. This is later, he receives another message that's the letter V. And these messages are received in New York, Hong Kong, London, to Marconi telegraphs or Marconi radios all over the world. And a scientist in Australia confirms that he received a letter M. And so suddenly this is really getting attention all over the world, because you have a reputable, you know, inventor and scientist who is saying, I received a message.
How do they know that it was coming? What made them think it was coming from Mars? Why wouldn't they think, this might be somebody in New York doing this?
It was because of the power of the signal they received at the time of day they received it. So there was they knew that it was too powerful to be an Earth-bound signal. So they assumed it must have come from outer space based on what they knew at that time.
Okay. And did they eventually figure out what it was?
Not exactly. There were scientists who began to research this and said, you know, maybe this is a solar flare. Marconi later sort of denounced the whole thing, saying, no, I never believed in Martians or any such thing, and said, you know, it was a signal that was magnified by, you know, the metal that was, you know, railroad tracks and all the metal that was, you know, across the world. And so there were really these outrageous sort of explanations to dismiss it as well.
So at the time, though, when they were thinking, okay, this might be the what we've been looking for, we're being contacted by the Martians, what was the consideration with regard to a response?
Well, there was, you know, newspapers started printing, you know, every theory that was coming out, every idea that would come out for this. So you had a lot of people saying, let's build giant spotlights and send, you know, flashes of light in Mars. Let's paint giant symbols in the middle of the desert and hope that they will see it. Constructing a radio tower on top of the Andes. There were lots of these ideas, but a lot of them weren't real practical with the technology they had at the time. A lot of them, just the scale was impractical. So they didn't really get sort of the following that they had hoped.
And then along comes Alexander Foster Humphrey. Who was he?
He was an inventor who lived on Pittsburgh's north side, and he had done some interesting inventions. He had worked on a submarine. He had invented bullets that would actually self-heal. They had built into them an antiseptic, and when they hit you, they would actually slowly dull the pain and make sure you didn't get an infection. So he had these quirky ideas. And he also had a fascination in munitions. So that sort of led to his idea for a response.
And what was his plan?
So his plan was to construct a 377-foot cannon. In that cannon, they would actually put in shells within a shell. So you would have sort of this two-tiered system. The first shell would be sent out with explosives into space, 100 miles into space. It would be protected from the heat with a special treated coating. And then that shell would release 5 additional shells.
So it's kind of like a rocket with a booster system?
It's kind of like a multi-stage rocket, only they're using powder. They're using 10 tons of powder to send this into space. So it's sort of an idea ahead of its time, this multi-stage, you know, for lack of better words, rocket.
And the idea of this was what?
Well, those 5 rockets would then split off, okay? They would give another boost, and then they would send 3 dot signals. It would be 3 explosions in space.
So that would be like a Morse code signal?
That would be a response, copying the code. But in order to make sure they knew that it was intelligent life behind it, they would repeat this once a day for 3 days, and then they would take a break, and they would do it again for 3 days. And this would extend over a month, making it clear that there was an intelligent force behind this signal. So it was really sort of this pretty creative solution. And, you know, people are just coming out of, you know, a world war. So the idea of using, you know, a giant gun and all these, you know, powder seems a lot more practical. It actually, as silly as it may seem to us now, it was actually a pretty practical solution to getting something into space. But you have to remember, it wouldn't be until the 1940s that we would spend any object into space or any object that would be capable of going to space. So this is really sort of an inventive idea.
I'm kind of wondering if a signal came through, or what they thought was a message was coming through on a telegraph, why they wouldn't just try to telegraph it back.
They didn't think the signals would be powerful enough.
Okay.
You know, now we can send a signal to Mars and it takes about 30 minutes. So it's about an hour round trip. But at this time, it just wasn't powerful. It took Marconi years. He would start with being able to get a message across, you know, a yard, and then a message across a neighborhood, then across a city, and then across countries, and then across the world. But it took a lot of time to constantly build those transmitters more and more powerful.
It's amazing how much has changed in less than 100 years. We're almost at the 100th anniversary of all this happening. And in the meantime, here's Alexander Foster Humphrey, prominent Pittsburgher. We don't talk about him so much today. His name is not out there with Tesla and Marconi. he faded into obscurity, but do you think that he has had a lasting legacy?
You know, a lot of his pieces he made, his submarine, his bullets and stuff, were on display at the Carnegie Museums for many years. They have since sort of vanished. The submarine, a model that he had made, ended up on an auction site in the year 2003. So, you know, that aspect of his legacy is sort of gone. But I think what his greater legacy is man for thousands of years had looked to the skies and said, you know, are we alone? And he was one of the first men to say, instead of asking, are we alone, let's send a signal out to the universe to say, we are here. You are not alone.
We're down to just a few seconds. Should Pittsburgh be doing more to remember this man, Alexander Foster Humphrey?
Yes, I think he has a great legacy, and I think we need to look more at these kind of people who are forgotten in our history and what they have done.
Well, you haven't forgotten him, Joe Woese, and I appreciate your joining us here today to tell us the story of Alexander Foster Humphrey. Fascinating.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening. Tomorrow on Essential Pittsburgh, we'll take you to the Strip District for an in-depth look at the issues facing this unique Pittsburgh neighborhood. Until then, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. So long for now.